They're not there for us on Iceland, that I can tell you. I mean, our stock market took the first dip yesterday because of Iceland. So Iceland's already cost us a lot of money.
Actually, the country you're planning to invade is Greenland. Nice if you got that straight first.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
So Iceland should be careful.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
At this point.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
So should we
and
all.
I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Good Lord. From Pacifica Radio in Iceland, I'm sorry, Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA, and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us for another crazy day in Trump world, which, as you know, now includes the entire globe, including both Greenland and, sure, why not, maybe Iceland. Who knows? We'll see how things go. Ryan Cooper of The Prospect joins us momentarily regarding European pushback to Trump's madness on his vow to take over Greenland, a NATO ally as a territory of the Kingdom of Denmark, and on some of the insanity at the World Economic Forum on Wednesday, where Donald Trump spoke about Greenland and, yes, Iceland, I guess, accidentally.
Good luck keeping up with it all.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks. Thanks. I'll take it. I'll take any encouragement I can get. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
All of that before announcing some form of a deal that Trump made with NATO, so he says. I'll get to all of that shortly, but quickly, there were a couple of special elections on Tuesday for vacant state House and Senate seats in both the Virginia and Georgia legislatures. In Virginia, in a very Democratic-leaning district, the Kamala Harris won in 2024 by 43 points. Democrat Garrett McGuire easily defeated his Republican opponent for the House of Delegates in the 17th district by about 56 points.
Wow.
So continuing what we saw all last year, another Democratic overperformance by 13 points in this case, which has pretty much been the average for Democrats over the first year of Trump's second term. The Republicans in the U.S. House, who won by 13 points or less in 2024, I would argue, maybe ought to be quite concerned about their futures as of this November's midterm elections, I would suggest. And in Georgia's state Senate District 18 on Tuesday, in a very Trumpy district that Donald Trump won by 2024 by about 20 points. Well, there was a five-way race. There was only one Democrat running. So in that case, we really can't learn anything conclusive for now other than nobody won by more than 50%. So there will be a runoff in a few weeks in Georgia, though the lone Democrat in that contest did win a ticket to that runoff. Democrat Lamario Nicholas Brown will face off against Republican Stephen McNeil, at least if the reported results as of today end up holding up. It was a very close race between three of the Republicans on the ballot on Tuesday, and I suspect there may be calls for recounts among those three Republicans. But the Democrat received far and away more votes than anyone else, so will certainly be included in the runoff in the coming weeks. In other related elections news today, as you may know, at the moment, Republicans in the U.S. House can afford to lose just one single vote on any issue and still ensure passage of any particular thing. But with a razor-thin majority right now of 218 to 213, it actually means, for the moment, that they can lose just one vote, but if a second Republican wants to flip over to the Democratic side on any issue, the House vote would actually result in a tie. And that's because even though Republicans currently hold a 218, a 213 advantage, one of their members, Indiana's Jim Baird, is still hospitalized following a car accident over the holidays. So it's actually 217 to 213 right now in favor of the GOP in the House. If a Republican then votes with the Dems, the Republicans would still win 216 to 214. But if one more Republican flips, presuming everyone is in attendance on both sides, then it would be a 215 to 215 tie. There are currently four seats vacant in the House with Baird in the hospital. I guess it counts as five seats at the moment. But at month's end, on January 31, there's going to be a special election for the U.S. House in Texas for the very Democratic-leaning Houston-based 18th Congressional District down there to fill the seat left vacant by the death of Democratic Congressman Sylvester Turner last year. Turner's seat became vacant when he died in March of 2025, March 5, at the beginning of the month last year. So despite how close the margin is currently in the U.S. House, or perhaps because of it, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott, well, he decided to leave the people of Houston without representation for 11 months before allowing the special election at what I believe is the latest date possible under Texas law. So with that in mind, it has been somewhat rich over the past few days since California's Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, declared the date for a special election for the U.S. House out here in California to fill the seat left vacant by the unexpected death of Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa earlier this month. It has been somewhat rich to hear the outrage from Republicans about how long Newsom is waiting to schedule that election. As Emily Singer noted it on Tuesday at Daily Coast, Republicans are up in arms after California Governor Gavin Newsom set a special election to fill a GOP-held House seat for August 4, the latest date that he could under state law. The move ensures that the seat left vacant with the death of LaMalfa in a very Republican district, at least Republican for now. That may change with the new U.S. House maps that California has adopted in response to the Texas Trump gerrymander. But that means that LaMalfa's seat will be open for 8 months, thereby robbing House Speaker Mike Johnson of a critical vote in his incredibly narrow and unruly majority. National Republican Congressional Committee Chair Richard Hudson is furious, saying, quote, Gavin Newsom's decision to punt this special election to August is a blatant waste of taxpayer dollars and a disservice to the people of California's 1st District. He could have scheduled this election alongside the June primary, but instead chose to leave this seat vacant for months. Californians deserve a voice in Congress, and Newsom is denying them one for purely political reasons. And that's correct. He is. Politics ain't beanbag. What goes around comes around and all of that. Do I think that it is outrageous that the voters in California's 1st Congressional District will be without representation for 8 months? Yes, I do. I think it's terrible. Almost as terrible as Greg Abbott keeping voters in Texas's 18th Congressional District without representation for 11 months. So it's almost as bad, but not quite. Am I right, Texas? It's also how, if you want my opinion, Democrats do need to be playing politics right now in this twisted Trump era, whether I like it or not. I feel the same way about this that I did about Prop 50, the special election to retalimander California in response to Trump and Texas stealing five seats from minority voters last year. Retaliation gerrymander, in case you're wondering what that means.
I was wondering, actually.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I as I said at the time, I thought it was both terrible and the absolute right thing to do, whether I like it or not. Republican Congressman Daryl Issa of California, one of the Republicans almost certain to lose his seat this year, thanks to California's Texas retalimander, also complained, writing in a post on social media, quote, "When it's a Democrat seat, Newsom says the goal is representation as soon as possible. When it's Republican, he purposely leaves constituents stranded." I know. Sad. Ain't it, Daryl? By the way, did I miss your outrage when Texas gerrymandered five Democratic seats off of their already gerrymandered map? Did I miss your outrage about Governor Abbott waiting 11 months for an election to fill Sylvester Turner's seat? Or the nearly 2 months after Adelita Grijalva won her special election in September before Mike Johnson would deemed to swear her into office? Did I miss your outrage on that, Congressman Issa? Of course, observed Singer at Daily Coast, Newsom was just giving Republicans a taste of their own medicine. GOP governors have held Democratic-leaning seats open for even longer, she notes, as a way to help House Republicans. She goes on to cite that seat that Abbott left open for 11 months until the end of this coming month. And by the way, the government is set to shut down again, potentially, at the end of January, pretty much on election day for that special election in Texas. So unless the two parties can strike a deal to keep it open, it may shut down again. And if it closes, will Speaker Mike Johnson once again refuse to swear in an elected Democrat to the House, this time down in Texas, the way he refused to swear in the Arizona Democrat? Claiming that, he couldn't do it while the House was shut down, even though he had sworn in Republican members during previous shutdowns. Also in Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis kept the seat of the late Democratic Congressman Alcee Hastings vacant for 9 months, starting back in 2021, which ended up robbing Democrats of a vote in a critical period of then-President Joe Biden's first year in office, notes Singer. Did the National Republican Congressional Committee chair forget to complain about that at the time? I don't remember seeing it. Singer correctly observes that they weren't complaining then. They whine only now when a Democrat is using Republicans' hardball tactics against them. Indeed, she writes, that should be a feather in Newsom's cap in what is expected to be a crowded Democratic primary field in the 2028 presidential race. Newsom has consistently fought fire with fire, which I think is a good thing, by the way, while Republicans are burning down the nation and the world. Yeah, we could use some fire around here. Including from Newsom, who shepherded through that mid-decade redistricting effort, which thwarted Trump's efforts to rig the midterm elections for Republicans, at least a little. Back in August, when Newsom launched the redistricting effort, he explained why it's so critical that Democrats do whatever they can to fight back against Trump and the GOP, saying, quote, "We're not going to act as if anything is normal any longer." Newsom said at the time, it's not about whether we play hardball anymore. It's about how we play hardball. And California has your back, he said. With his decision to hold California's first district now open as long as possible, Newsom is proving that to be true once again. And yes, I both hate it. And yes, think it's absolutely the right thing for him to do politically. In other news today, Donald Trump's personal insurance lawyer turned top prosecutor, U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, Lindsey Halligan, who was ordered by a federal judge yesterday to stop using the title of U.S. attorney since her appointment was found to have been illegal. Well, she gave up the ghost shortly after we got off air yesterday. She stepped down from the job that she never legally held in the district, where her Trump revenge indictments of former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James were dismissed thanks to her illegal appointment. Her legal appointment by the Department of Justice, by the way. Trump appears to be expanding his federal invasion of Democratic-leaning states today with a new immigration enforcement campaign now said to be underway in the great state of Maine, which, like Minneapolis, has a sizable Somali-American population and a Democratic governor who has stood up to Donald Trump in the past. So not so much immigration enforcement, I guess, as revenge enforcement there as well in Maine. In the Supreme Court on Wednesday morning, oral arguments were heard in the case of Trump's attempt to fire the Biden-appointed Federal Reserve Governor, Lisa Cook, with a majority of the corrupted court, believe it or not, appearing to oppose Trump's firing of Cook based on specious grounds and without any due process whatsoever. So we will see. For now, Cook continues to serve on that board. And on Wednesday morning, Donald Trump addressed the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, as you heard at the top of the show here, including with a bunch of racist remarks about Somali Americans and repeatedly confused Iceland for Greenland amidst his latest tantrums, including his renewed vows to take over Greenland and to impose huge tariffs on our European NATO allies who oppose such a takeover. Amid his rambling remarks on Wednesday in Davos, as our friend John Amato, a Crooks and Liars blog, headlined his coverage, quote, "Grandpa Stupid forgets NATO came to the aid of U.S. over 9/11. Writes John, quote, "During his lie-filled speech in Davos this morning to a thoroughly annoyed audience, Trump continued to undermine the NATO alliance by claiming that they never did anything for the United States and always treated us badly, forgetting how NATO immediately came to our aid after the attack on 9/11. As the U.S. became, on the day after that horrific attack, the first and only NATO member nation to ever invoke Article 5, mandating that an attack on one NATO nation will be regarded as an attack on all NATO members who quickly came to our aid thereafter." Apparently, Donald Trump seems to have forgotten.
NATO has treated the United States of America very unfairly. We never asked for anything. We never got anything. We actually took care of the needs of NATO for years and years, which I felt was always unfair. So I got NATO to pay because they're rich countries. But I think it's time that NATO step up.
Yeah, well, NATO did step up after 9/11. I realize you were busy measuring your skyscrapers at the time to determine if you had the tallest one in Manhattan, as you noted, on September 11, after the towers had been knocked down. And by the way, NATO doesn't pay. NATO members don't pay. But what he's talking about there is how much of their GDP each nation puts into its military. And he has been encouraging them to pay more. So did Barack Obama. So did Joe Biden.
But they, Obama and Biden, actually understood how
they
the system, what
about.
They were talking about. Trump is ignorant and stupid, and no matter how many times anybody tries to tell him, he persists in this very wrong, stupid belief.
He knows. He knows. But he likes to say, "I made them pay."
Yeah.
Anyway, as John Amato notes, the day after 9/11, NATO stepped up in a big way on behalf of the U.S., but in Trump's addled brain, that never happened. And speaking of Trump's addled brain at Davos, during his remarks regarding Greenland, Trump, for the first time, I believe, said that he would not use military force to take over that country. Shortly after his remarks, as the U.S. stock market returned to its previous day's plummeting numbers, Trump announced on his failing social media site what he described as, quote, "the framework of a future deal with respect to Greenland." A framework of a future deal apparently struck with the Secretary General of NATO. We will discuss all of that momentarily with the American prospect's Ryan Cooper. But on Tuesday, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney received a rare standing ovation at Davos for his stark description of the dramatic shift we are seeing now in geopolitics thanks to Donald Trump's threats to take over Greenland. Now, I had actually hoped to air more of Carney's rather exceptional and arguably history-making speech at Davos, but for Trump's latest antics, upending our plans a little bit here, as is the case many times these days. But although Carney never mentioned the U.S. or Trump by name in his speech, it was pretty clear what he was talking about. His message was, in fact, very clear that Canada, our close friend Canada, and the world are now at a turning point, a point of no return, if you will. Carney said, quote, "We're in the midst of a rupture, not a transition," referring to the old rules-based international world order led by and underpinned by, of course, the United States, at least until now. Carney said that in an era of unfettered great powers, middle power nations such as Canada should build a new world order for themselves, forming new coalitions for mutual benefit. And he made the case for Canada as a nation with vast natural resources that has proven it as a stable, predictable international ally with integrity, a tacit contrast, sadly, to the now erratic, belligerent, and unreliable U.S. under Donald Trump. Here are a few of Carney's remarks.
"We understand that this rupture calls for more than adaptation. It calls for honesty about the world as it is. We are taking the sign out of the window. We know the old order is not coming back. We shouldn't mourn it. Nostalgia is not a strategy. But we believe that from the fracture, we can build something bigger, better, stronger, more just. This is the task of the middle powers. The countries that have the most to lose from a world of fortresses and most to gain from genuine cooperation. The powerful have their power. But we have something too. The capacity to stop pretending, to name reality, to build our strength at home, and to act together. That is Canada's path. We choose it openly and confidently, and it is a path wide open to any country willing to take it with us. Thank you very much."
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking at the World Economic Forum this week. Our old friend Canada said that the world needs to move on, essentially, without the U.S. And by the way, in recent days, he has put his money where his mouth is. For example, he opened up the Canadian market to electric vehicles made in China, where there had previously been a 100% tariff on them to lock them out of the Canadian market. No longer. They were locked out, essentially, in favor of U.S.-made vehicles. So now China's EVs are in Canada. Great job, Donald Trump. So Canada is pushing back. Is that what we're about to see from Europe, from our good allies overseas? Well, if so, at what cost? Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with Ryan Cooper of The Prospect to talk about that and more. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the broadcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. "Something in Europe has snapped," wrote the BBC's Europe editor, Katja Adler, on Tuesday. Earlier in the week, Donald Trump doubled down again on his insistence that the U.S., quote, "has to have Greenland for national security reasons," she writes. He predicted that Europe's leaders, quote, "aren't going to push back too much," But she reported that wasn't the plan that European leaders had in mind for when they crossed paths with the U.S. president at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland on Wednesday. Greenland, of course, is a semi-autonomous territory of Denmark, a member of the EU and of NATO. President Trump, she says, is now leaning heavily on Denmark's allies in both those organizations to abandon Denmark and let the U.S. take control of Greenland or face punitive taxes paid by U.S. consumers, by the way, on all of their exports to the United States. It's a horror scenario for European economies, especially those reliant on exporting to the U.S., like Germany's car industry and Italy's luxury goods market. On Monday, Germany's finance minister said, quote, "We will not allow ourselves to be blackmailed," after an emergency meeting ahead of the World Economic Forum. The Trump threats landed like a slap in the face of European governments, she says, who separately, in the case of the EU and the UK, had only just now settled tariff deals with the U.S. president last year in July. Quote, "We're living through uncharted territories," said France's finance minister. "We've never seen this before. An ally, a friend of 250 years, is considering using tariffs as a geopolitical weapon." His German counterpart added, quote, "A line has been crossed. Today, I'm not saying exactly what will happen, but one thing must be clear. Europe must be prepared." All of a sudden, observes the BBC, the softly approach to Trump that Europe's leaders had clearly favored since he returned for a second term to the White House seems to have passed its sell-by date. And it's not just the European liberals, by the way, that the Trump administration, they love to hate them. It's not only them who are starting to realize maybe pushing back against Donald Trump rather than appeasing him would be a smart move right now. As Reuters reports today, European far-right and populist parties that once cheered on Donald Trump and gained in standing through his praise are now distancing themselves from the U.S. president over his military incursions into Venezuela and his bid for Greenland. The Trump administration has repeatedly backed far-right European parties that share a similar stance on issues from immigration to climate change, helping legitimize movements that have long faced stigma at home but are now on the rise. But those parties, says Reuters, now face a dilemma as disapproval of Trump rises across the continent over his increasingly aggressive foreign policy moves, and in particular his efforts to acquire Greenland from Denmark. Donald Trump has violated a fundamental campaign promise, namely not to interfere in other countries, said Alice Weidel of the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, party, while her party co-leader, Tino Chrupalla, rejected, quote, "Wild West methods." The AfD has been cultivating ties with Trump's administration, but polls suggest this may no longer be beneficial to them. A survey released on Tuesday showed 71% of Germans see Donald Trump more as an opponent than an ally at this point. France's right-wing National Party leader, Jordan Bardella, said on Tuesday, "Europe must react," referring to, quote, "anti-coercion measures and the suspension of the economic agreement that was signed just last year between the EU and the United States." British populist party Reform UK, whose leader Nigel Farage has long feted his close ties with Trump, said it was hard to tell if the president was bluffing, quote, "but to use economic threats against the country that's been considered to be your closest ally for over 100 years is not the kind of thing we would expect," said Farage and the Reform Party. Blunter still was Matthias Carlsson, often cited as the chief ideologist of the far-right Sweden Democrats. He said, quote, "Trump is increasingly resembling a reversed King Midas. Everything he touches turns to a word that I cannot say on FCC radio." So even the far-right nationalists in Europe are, to some extent at least, beginning to put space between themselves and Trump because, you know, that guy is crazy, said the craziest people in Europe. Quote, Trump is forcing the Europeans to grow a spine, says Nicolas Poitiers, an economist and expert in international trade at the Brussels-based Bruegel think tank, saying, quote, while the damage of Trump's tariffs is very manageable for Europe, the much bigger question here is not economic, but security and foreign policy. The EU cannot afford to not react, he said. Perhaps all of that and both the European and American stock markets cratering on Tuesday got Donald Trump's attention, maybe. On Wednesday, during a bizarre, rambling set of remarks to the World Economic Forum in Davos, he seemed to somewhat cool his rhetoric against Greenland, who he repeatedly referred to as Iceland during his remarks, by declaring for the first time, I think, that he did not plan on using military force to take over Denmark's Arctic territory, at least if you feel like believing him.
We never ask for anything, and we never got anything. We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that. Okay, now everyone's saying, oh, good. That's probably the biggest statement I made because people thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force.
With Donald Trump in Davos, Switzerland on Wednesday. And, well, that's good if you believe him. On Wednesday morning at the American Prospect, Ryan Cooper wrote, Donald Trump is back on his, well, another word that I can't say on FCC radio. After seemingly forgetting about it for several months, he's now once again demanding to conquer Greenland. He is, observes Ryan, at least straightforwardly clear about the motivations for such a patently insane act. His personal feelings. Quote, ownership is very important, he told the New York Times. That's what I feel is psychologically needed for success. I think that ownership gives you a thing that you can't do with a lease or a treaty. Ryan writes, as someone who has, alas, spent a disturbingly large fraction of my professional career observing and writing about Donald Trump, oh, I feel you, Ryan, I have some comradely advice for the forces of freedom and democracy around the world. Stand up to him. It's not a guarantee of success, but like all idiot bullies, Trump only respects strength and aggression, and at bottom, he is also a coward. Appeasement will only lead him coming back for a second helping. Cooper goes on to detail a number of suggestions that the EU and UK could deploy if Trump continues with his Greenland obsession. But within the past hour, it seems, Trump is already, well, chickening out, claiming that some sort of deal or framework, a concept of a plan, if you will, has now been struck with the Secretary General of NATO, which Trump also attacked during his remarks earlier in the day, claiming that NATO had never done anything for the U.S., even though the U.S. is the only nation to have invoked its Article 5, an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us provision following 9/11, when all of the NATO nations came to the aid of the U.S. But on his failing social media site, Trump pasted within the past hour or so, quote, based upon a very productive meeting that I've had with the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, we have formed the framework of a future deal with respect to Greenland and, in fact, the entire Arctic region. This solution, he writes, if consummated, will be a great one for the United States of America and all NATO nations. Based upon this understanding, he said, I will not be imposing the tariffs that were scheduled to go into effect on February 1st. Joining us now to help us make any kind of sense of any of this is Ryan Cooper, managing editor of the American Prospect, author of How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Questions in Politics, and of his article today at the Prospect headlined How the Free World Can Fight Mad King Trump. Oh, Ryan Cooper, welcome back to the broadcast, sir, and Happy New Year.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. So, Ryan, I've had to sort of rewrite today's lead for this segment about five different times today as the story, such as there is a real story here at all, has changed that many times in a single day. So let me start here. First, Ryan, should the world believe Trump when he says that, well, he could use force, but he will not use force. I think those remarks at Davos were the first time that he has committed to that. And also, why do you think he felt it necessary to do so for the first time on Wednesday at Davos?
I mean, I would say that you basically can't trust any word that comes out of Donald Trump's big flapping potty mouth. I think that it is notable that he said he wouldn't do it because he usually doesn't do that. You know, if anyone ever suggests any kind of limit on what his freedom of action, saying, Trump, is there a thing that you couldn't do? He will almost never agree. And I think that it suggests that, you know, he has sort of been talked into, you know, slash convinced himself that it would be unwise, you know, to actually do, you know, a military operation. But I don't think, you know, you could take him at his word that he will keep to it, because he, you know, he doesn't. I think what is happening there with respect to Greenland is that he recognizes that, unlike what happened in Venezuela, where it was basically, you know, just a totally easy thing to do with practically zero resistance. You know, I mean, a number of people died, not minimizing that, but it wasn't like, you know, some sort of full-fledged, you know, war. But you know, the fact that all of these different European countries had deployed troops into the area, and that, and you know, that raised the possibility of actually getting in a shooting war with NATO allies, including ones which are orders of magnitude more formidable than Venezuela, suggests that he's, you know, he's chickening out. But that doesn't make him less dangerous. It, you know, he could return to this at a later date. And it's like a sort of, you know, a tiger that has sort of wandered off because you hit it in the nose with a, you know, chunk of rebar, that, you know, you need to be ready to hit it again should it come to that.
Until that Wednesday social media announcement, Trump had been claiming that he was going to impose a 10% tariff, a tax on all goods imported from European nations that opposed his takeover of Greenland, that they would be set to rise to, I believe, 25% by June if those nations didn't come around to supporting him in whatever he wanted to do in Greenland. Well, now he claims there's also some sort of deal to avoid those tariffs in the first place to have begun in February. Does that agreement, if it actually comes to pass, and I know the news has just broken in the last hour or so. He claims it's a framework, so we will see. But doesn't it prove, really, that, well, the folks in Europe seem to be taking your advice here to, you know, not roll over for a bad guy? They were suggesting they were going to push back if in fact these tariffs were put in place. Does it prove that Trump's tariffs threats on his own either worked, or that the EU's increasingly louder pushback, or at least talk of pushback, worked? What worked here? What has changed?
Well, it's something we will need a little bit more information, you know, detailed reporting, if we ever find it, to be able to say for certain. But my suspicion would be that Trump basically got snowed by the Secretary General of NATO, you know, Mark Rutte, or however you pronounce that. But I think that it would be completely possible that, you know, Trump is incredibly ignorant about everything. I think about three quarters of the motivation for his, you know, wanting to conquer Greenland is that he is looking at a Mercator projection of the globe, which exaggerates the size of Greenland by like a factor of 10, makes it look like the size of Africa when it's not anywhere close to that big. So if you were to just present Trump with a deal, which is just the status quo with respect to Greenland, that is the, you know, a big mutual defense pact and I mean, critically, for America's entire, you know, Cold War and post-Cold War nuclear deterrence, like, standpoint that we have basically unfettered access to almost the entire island for our, you know, troops and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You just hand that to him and say, look, here's the concessions that we're giving to you. He doesn't know anything about anything. This man can barely form a coherent sentence. And so you could present that to him as a concession and he could accept it. And of course, you know, with such a flighty individual, I would not expect him to necessarily hold to that. But that would be my guess. And what we don't know for certain either way until we get the details of what actually transpired in these meetings. But that would be my expectation of what was the actually the motivation.
Make him any deal that, you know, call it a deal, make him sound like he's a winner. I think we saw something similar in Mexico there, where the president, Claudia Sheinbaum, said, oh, okay, well, we'll send several thousand troops to the border. And he said, oh, great, we have a deal, we'll call off the tariffs. But in fact, they had already planned to send those troops to the border. But if you frame it as a deal, he thinks he made a deal. You could tell him it's a deal. You could tell him he's wonderful, and he seems to buy it. All of which kind of raises the question, Ryan Cooper, about who is the actual domestic political constituency for this bizarre move or this obsession with Greenland? Who actually wants this? You note that even the Republicans in the U.S. seem to be overwhelmingly opposed to, you know, various acts of war, whether it's a military war or a trade war against the NATO ally. I mean, what is all of this about in the first place, as you see it? Literally, the fact that he on the maps he saw, it looked like Greenland was huge. I mean, there's got to be more to it than that, no?
I mean, it might be. The New Republic ran an article today that was arguing, with some evidence, that there is a cohort of tech bros, Peter Thiel-aligned folks, who they think that, you know, Greenland is an important strategic asset. Mm-hmm. And I think you could probably add that to the mix, because the Thiel line, the PayPal mafia tech bro guys, are very influential in Trump world. But I don't think that Trump would expend this much personal, his legacy, his attention and his time on something that he didn't actually believe in. And I think you see the classic, you know, the fascist move that always cashes out in wars of conquest, and just, you know, your classic adventure conqueror mindset, you know, from Napoleon to Tamerlane, you know, Genghis Khan and stuff. It's like, I'm the leader, and to glorify myself, I am going to take this big piece of land, the bigger, the better. And I think also, you know, with Trump specifically, you look at how his business career collapsed. And it was because he compulsively betrayed everyone he ever worked with. You know, all of his contractors who did his drywall and his electrical work, he ripped them off. He refused to pay what he previously agreed. And I think that for his personal part of this, he wants Greenland because someone told him that he can't have it. He wants to take it by force because he likes taking things by force. And that is like from the very, his entire career in politics and his entire behavior, as we've learned all before that. Mm-hmm. If you're a star, they let you do it. They'll let you grab them by the, I won't say it on FCC radio, but we've all heard it.
Yeah.
That is who he is. He takes things.
When I read your piece today at The Prospect early this morning about the ways that the EU could push back if they wanted to, I thought to myself, well, you know, there's no way that the EU is going to face down this guy because it would hurt them as much or more than it would actually hurt the U.S. It would quickly devolve into an all-out trade war or worse, a military war with Donald Trump. But then I saw the BBC reporting, quote, EU diplomats have let it be known that they're considering imposing hundreds of billions of dollars worth of tariffs on U.S. goods, or even restricting the access of American businesses, possibly including banks and high-tech companies, if Trump goes ahead with his so-called Greenland tariffs, as they've become known. Now, while it now appears, for the moment anyway, at least for the time we're on the air right now, that Trump is backing down from those tariffs, if we believe his tweet today, you detailed about five different ways that the EU could, if they wanted to, push back against Trump, whether it's on Greenland or any other Mad King conquest that he, you know, sort of sets his sights on. I want to sort of step quickly through some of that leverage that you see the EU as having here against the U.S., because I think a lot of us see, well, you know what? If the U.S. decides they want to cut EU off, there's really nothing that EU can do about it, and they're in big trouble. But you describe a number of things sort of in order of increasing escalation, as you describe them, that I sort of want to step through. Arrows in the EU quiver, so to speak. First, as you describe it, punish Trump-supporting billionaires, above all Elon Musk. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, you just treat, you know, the most MAGA-aligned oligarchs in the United States like the wealthy world has treated Putin-aligned oligarchs after the invasion of Ukraine. You know, you sanction them, you take their money, you take their property, their yachts, you know, their gaudy possessions, and you prevent them from traveling to the European Union. You know, I think unlike the Russian oligarchs, you know, you're talking about a large cohort of people who have taken for granted that they can do basically whatever they want all the time. For decades now, particularly Elon Musk, you know, this is a guy who is off the chain, a guy who has donated, I mean, single-handedly, if you count the purchase of Twitter as a political contribution,
yeah,
which I think you should,
yeah,
that by itself makes the 2024 election the most expensive election in American history. You know, you impose some consequences on these people.
Can the EU afford to do that themselves? I mean, wouldn't that just come bouncing back at them with a guy like?
Yes,
yeah,
it would. No, I mean, this is the thing with sanctions in general. It's like a broadsword. It has two edges on it. It hurts, depending on the relationship, it hurts you about as much as it hurts the other guy, depending again on, you know, how the balance of trade in each direction. But the thing about that is that, you know, you demonstrate, you signal to the other party that you are willing to endure pain in order to stand up for yourself. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Europe with tech companies in particular is that the trade relationship is massively imbalanced towards the United States. Europe has a huge trade deficit in services with tech companies, in, you know, like mm-hmm. Meta, Alphabet, you know, Google, YouTube, all of that, mm-hmm. NVIDIA. And so, you know, it would hurt them to try, you know, ban, say, Facebook from the European continent on political grounds, or, you know, the, you know, sort of pushing the bounds of legality here about the justification for this stuff to where it becomes like a sort of pragmatic emergency rather than, oh, you followed all the incredibly elaborate EU regulations and so on. But, you know, at a certain point, it's like, well, if you're in something that is looking more like a conflict, more like a sort of, you know, Cold War almost,
yeah.
if you say, well, I will not endure any pain myself, you're just giving up. And, you know, so I think that, you know, Europe should be ready to starting. That would be my first two steps to take. And in fact, that has already proved more than enough to, you know, attack the billionaires, the thing that maybe happened a little bit, but tank the markets. I think they didn't even have to do that much because when Trump was out there rambling, the markets started to tank, and he is already apparently given up just because of that. And if it were the case to say that, you know, the top two or three big tech companies were banned from Europe for an indeterminate period, that would tank the American stock market. Seven companies are 35% of the S&P 500. And Europe is one of their biggest markets, like probably the second most important one after the United States itself. And so there's a lot of leverage there. It would hurt to pull that lever, but it's something you have to be ready to do to, you know, protect freedom and democracy around the world, including in the United States.
And I think that that's some of what the EU had been talking about. They referred to their bazooka option. I guess that's the equivalent of the nuclear option in some sense. But the bazooka option, I think, was to do exactly that and was to begin enacting sanctions against American companies, American billionaires, just the way that the U.S. and the EU has enacted, as you suggest, against Putin and his oligarchic allies. I'll point folks to your piece at the American Prospect for the other points, but I want to catch this one that you suggest. Deploy James Bond. Well, that's sexy. What does that mean, Ryan?
Well, you look at the reporting of Trump, the Trump administration this year, the second Trump administration, who was involved in that and how do they behave? You're talking about some of the most degenerate people who have ever held high office in any country around the world in history. You know, just a bunch of reality TV people who have, in many cases, credible accusations of sexual assault or worse, and who, in many cases, have credible reports of substance abuse problems and have been not just credibly reported, but proved to have incredibly sensitive, you know, United States government communications happening on their own personal cell phones on unvetted third-party apps. This administration has the worst information security of any in history by a mile. You know, it's going to take us a decade to even dig out from under all the compromises from all the foreign governments. But that's an opportunity for our European comrades. Get your spies out there. Find the nerds in the country if you don't have any spies yet. Find some spies. It won't be that difficult. Find all of the most inflammatory private communications from all the top administration officials. You know these people. They're sicko, degenerate freaks who they're all having affairs with each other's wives and husbands all the time. They all have substance abuse problems. Look at, I could name a lot of different examples of MAGA aligned, you know, people who have been soliciting like underage prostitutes and whatnot. But the point is, cause them some embarrassment, do some information warfare, some espionage, some classic stuff. You don't need to have a Walter, you know, PBK or whatever it is necessarily, but, you know, get them on the computer and find a Whiskey Pete's signal messages where he's telling about the sensitive movements of the United States military to various journalists and editors.
The EU
can't be that hard.
Yeah, I mean, there are options here. The EU does have agency in this matter. They don't have to roll over. It seems like this Greenland incident may have finally, at least politely, given them that idea. We will see if, and I'll point folks to your piece over at the American Prospect, how the free world can fight Mad King Trump. It seems like maybe that is what they are finally beginning to understand. We will see if, in fact, this supposed framework of a maybe NATO agreement, we'll see if that forestalls the need for any of this. But I think it's a good idea to keep your list, Ryan Cooper, standing by. We've got in theory, three more years of this, and who knows what other additional new crap he's going to pull. I had actually hoped to talk to you today, Ryan, about your story last week at the Prospect headlined Trump's ethnic cleansing campaign in Minneapolis, but we were sort of overtaken today by this Greenland idiocy. I'll point folks to your piece on the Minneapolis idiocy, which the way things are going, well, I may be calling you to discuss anyway in the not too distant future. So thanks for jumping in with us today, Ryan. We'll shout out for the next idiocy when it comes over the next, I'm sure, hour or two.
My pleasure.
Thanks, man. Ryan Cooper can be found over at prospect.org. He can be found on the Blue Skies at ryanlcooper.com. His book is How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Question in Politics. And he's also the co-host of the Left Anchor podcast. You can get more information on Blue Sky at Left Anchor. Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Okie dokie then.
Okay, one thing right before we get out.
Yes.
You had asked Ryan about whether he believed Trump when Trump said in his speech that he was not going to use military force against Greenland.
Right.
Well, a few moments after that in Trump's speech, he actually threatened Europe with dire economic and security consequences if he didn't get his way.
They have a choice. You can say yes, and we will be very appreciative. Or you can say no, and we will remember.
So I don't know that it makes sense to take Trump at his word on anything when he says he won't do it.
Wait a minute. Are you saying Trump is lying to him? When has Donald Trump ever lied to you before?
He lies like he breathes.
So we will see. You know, how much of this he actually means. It would be, I guess, an hour or so later when he would go on to say, oh, I just made a deal with the head of NATO. Or at least a framework for a deal. So everything's off. We don't have to worry about everything. We can all be friends again. We will see. I hope that this has served to light a fire in any event under the European nations so that they realize, no, America cannot be trusted. Y'all need to go your own way and look out for yourselves until we can...
This is a rupture
get
that's
healthy again. Here.
Yeah. But most importantly, I think this is a rupture that will take a very long time to heal, if ever. Lots of work ahead.
God, he's stupid. All right, we got to get out. Thanks again to Ryan Cooper of The Prospect. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always greatly appreciated and an honor. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can get at them, all of them, for free anytime at bradblog.com. No paywall there, made possible by those of you who are kind enough to hit a donate button when you stop by or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to sign up for a monthly subscription to help keep us on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at the Brad Blog. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, Iceland.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.